Greetings and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, co-chair of the Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum of the Commonwealth Club of California, and the chair for this meeting. And now it is my pleasure to turn over the meeting to Dr. Tim Murphy of the California Psychiatric Association, who introduced our speaker, Congressman Tim Murphy, who will speak on reforming our broken mental health system.
Well, thank you. It's my great pleasure to stand before you in this venerable institution and to introduce the Honorable Tim Murphy. In my own psychiatric practice in the small city of Fallbrook in San Diego County, where I am often called to the emergency room to see patients in crisis, I know too well that we are failing to provide for the treatment needs of our most vulnerable citizens. Congressman Murphy is trying to do something about it. The California Psychiatric Association, of which I have the honor of representing as president, represents over 3,000 psychiatrists across the state, and we believe that his efforts are giving our nation the best opportunity in a generation to strengthen our mental health care systems, particularly for those with the most serious disorders. As a disclaimer, I should tell you that the congressman and I are not related, even though we share the same first name and the same last name. And even though we're both doctors, Congressman Murphy is a clinical psychologist, and he treated patients and helped families for three decades before his election to the U.S. House of Representatives. Even now, Congressman Murphy continues his clinical work in his role as a lieutenant commander serving in the Navy Reserve Medical Corps. He treats patients with traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress at the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center at Bethesda, Maryland. On Capitol Hill, Representative Murphy represents the 16th Congressional District in Pennsylvania, which includes some of South Pittsburgh and several surrounding communities. He has demonstrated passionate leadership in Congress on issues involving mental health. Among his many accomplishments, he is co-chair of the Mental Health Caucus of the House of Representatives. He is a founding member of the GOP Doctors Caucus. He has authored significant legislation, including the Mental Health Security for American Families in Education Act, which was passed and signed into law, providing for treatment for students suffering from depression and other mental illnesses. Also, the Seniors Access to Mental Health Act, also signed into law, ending Medicare's discriminatory practice of charging higher copays for mental health care. But apparently, these actions were just a warm-up for the congressman. So now let me tell you how Congressman Murphy has so garnered the keen attention of the CPA, the APA, that's the American Psychiatric Association, NAMI, the Treatment Advocacy Center, and many other esteemed national organizations, and why we are all here today. Congressman Murphy chairs the House Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. In that role, he conducted a series of hearings after the awful tragedy of Sandy Hook. He received input from thousands of citizens, especially from families touched by mental illness, as well as clinicians and law enforcement. He focused on what needs fixing in our system of mental health care delivery, particularly for the seriously mentally ill, culminating in his proposed H.R. 3717, the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. It offers nothing less than comprehensive reform of our mental health services delivery system. The themes, values, and principles of this bill are things that the California Psychiatric Association enthusiastically applauds. We believe that Congress needs to seize this unique opportunity to enact the reforms that have such tremendous potential to make a difference. As NAMI Director Mary Ghiliberti recently noted, mental illness does not discriminate. It affects Democrats and Republicans alike. Congressman Murphy, a Republican, has come to a very Democratic city to promote his bill. Reform requires and deserves bipartisan support. We must ask our representatives to give his proposals their most serious consideration. So now let's give an enthusiastic welcome to Congressman Tim Murphy and thank him for all of his efforts on behalf of the mentally ill families. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning. It's an honor to be here. And I want to thank the Commonwealth Club and Bill Grant, Fred Martin, who I understand couldn't be here, and California Psychiatric Association, and my twin separated at birth, Tim Murphy. I'm humbled to be here among a group of people who give me inspiration. You have stories of triumph that give hope to millions, not only here in this region or throughout the California, but really throughout the nation. When I started this mission, I knew that there were problems. And after the shootings at Sandy Hook, and as chairman of Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee on the Committee on Energy and Commerce, I was tasked to come forth with analyzing what the problems were and a plan. But even though I knew there were problems going into this, I was amazed at how much worse the situation really is. That when we heard from families and professionals and patients, really thousands of them throughout the country, how painful the stories were. Now I want to start off with some important baseline observations and beliefs that are extremely important, that if you don't understand what I'm about to say, nothing that follows will make sense to you. But it begins with this. First of all, I believe people with mental illness can and do get better with treatment. Number two, this treatment must include a spectrum of options based upon the needs of the individual, not the biases of people who are treating or people in the community who don't understand what we're talking about. The spectrum includes psychotherapy, psychosocial therapy, medication, inpatient and outpatient treatment when necessary, peer support, community support, employment support. And what I mean is the wide spectrum here, from housing to help on every level. And that if any element of that is denied to the patient because of someone's pre-existing bias, that gets in the way of the individual getting better. Even though they may be well-intended, it goes without saying that good intentions do not guarantee good results, no matter how emotionally involved a person is with those good intentions. And I want to make sure that people in this country who are dealing with mental illness, the families, the individuals, the providers, law enforcement, judges, people in the community on every level, understand that those options are necessary. Now, unfortunately, you've heard these stories, you live these stories, and some are unable to get any sorts of these treatment before a tragedy occurs. But the overriding theme since Newtown, and actually there's been several other national tragedies since then too, the Navy Yard shooting. I mean, you look back in time, we know many of these tragedies by names, by their victims, or by the location in Tucson, in Aurora, in Columbine, the list goes on. We've had several, quite frankly, in Pittsburgh, and some in my district that have been the tragedies that get in national news. And understand that that what has gotten the news has gotten our attention, and it should motivate us to act, although that is not the whole problem by far. But generally what it alerts us to is the fact that we have a broken system that has not caused anybody alert until after the crisis. Let's look at some of these disturbing statistics. 60 million Americans with some level of a diagnosable mental illness, from the very mild, transient problem to a deep, persistent, and severe mental illness. You have 10 million persons with severe mental illness, such as bipolar, schizophrenia, or deep depression. And 4 million of those are not in treatment. There is an average between first symptoms and first treatment of 112 weeks. And sadly, for many folks with severe mental illness, their first encounter with any professional is law enforcement. Persons with mental illness are 3 to 10 times more likely to be victims of violence, crimes, assaults, robberies, rapes. And I ask, isn't that enough alone to take a reason for action that they are so broadly and persistently victimized? Apparently not. Children with a diagnosis of mental illness are 3 to 4 times more likely to be the victims of a sexual assault. And isn't that enough reason? Well, apparently not. This country last year, there was 40,000 suicides, 1 million attempts, over 2.5 million suicide plans, and many, many more, at least, thoughts of suicide. Is that reason enough to take action, that we have almost as many people who died in the last 12 months from suicide, almost as many as died in the Vietnam Wars? Apparently that's not enough reason either. Is it enough reason to understand that the average lifespan for a person with schizophrenia is 25 years less than that of the general population because of things like suicide, chronic illnesses, the homelessness, the persistent problems they have? Apparently that's not enough either. More than a third of the mentally ill are homeless. In some jails, over half the prisoners are mentally ill, about 30 to 50% in state penitentiaries, a higher percentage in county and community jails. And that among those, the Cook County Jail in Chicago is the biggest psychiatric hospital in America, even though it's not a hospital, although the Los Angeles County Jail also ranks right up there in the top. That's hardly giving someone freedom and rights to be in jail and to wait for that point before we finally get them treatment, where they can get medication and psychotherapy, as limited as it may be in a jail cell. So isn't that enough reason for us to take action? But apparently not. But then comes the attention of 13 dead at Columbine High School, 6 dead and 18 shot in Tucson, Arizona, 12 killed and 58 shot in Aurora, Colorado movie theater, 12 dead in the Navy Yard in Washington, D.C., and the 26 people, 20 of whom were children, who died at Sandy Hook Elementary School. And now we have America's attention. And people are fighting back and forth and said, but wait, those with mental illness are not the violent ones. Well, actually, someone with severe persistent mental illness in treatment is 15 times less likely to be involved with violence than someone who is in treatment. And so what happens is we know the names now of Adam Lanza and Aaron Alexis and James Holmes and Jared Lochner and Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold, and we know that they had mental illness. We also know that they were undertreated or not treated. We also know that in many of these cases of mental illness with the headline tragedies, that parents and family members desperately sought to get that person in care for months and years, and constantly running up against walls and barriers frequently established by state and federal government that said, you cannot get your son or daughter or brother or sister or mother and father or cousin or anybody else or your friend in care or in treatment until we witness them almost literally with a knife to their throat or someone else's. What kind of a sick system have we established in this country where we say the only way you're going to get treatment is when practically it's too late? Can you imagine if we did the same things in our country with heart disease and said, a doctor says, you know, you're developing heart disease, but we're not going to allow you any treatment until you have a heart attack. Diabetes, well, your blood sugar is abnormal. We see a lot of bad signs here, but until you are in kidney failure, we're not going to treat that. Can you imagine with lung disease or cancer? It says, until you're in stage 4 cancer, we're not going to begin any treatment. That is bizarre, and it is wrong. So what has the federal government done in to respond to the needs of the mentally ill in the last several years? We closed the old asylums, as they should have been closed. But then we cut outpatient care. We shut down group homes because some people say they shouldn't even live in groups. Let them live individually, even though in many cases they cannot. We restrict access to medication. We have a bizarre Medicaid law that says you can only see one doctor in a day. We have another Medicaid law that says we can't let you stay in an inpatient bed if you have more than 16 beds or if you're within a certain age group, as if suddenly and magically mental illness disappears between ages 22 and 64. Yet we spend $130 billion per year on the federal level on mental illness or mental health without any demand for results. Isn't that amazing? $130 billion of our taxpayer dollars, and no one has dared to ask the question, does it work? And in my bill, as I've introduced, I said that is going to be a cornerstone of legislation that we heard constantly. We heard some grants have gone out to organizations that admittedly do incredibly good work, and they should be strengthened. And other ones, you scratch your head and say, why was this funded at all? And can the people doing these studies or the people who are funding produce any evidence that they're making a difference? And I believe if there is no evidence or if it's questionable, you cut their funding. If it's redundant, you merge it. If it's good, you build it up. But for some reason in this country, the federal government has refused to do this, in part because you also have many groups that consider their first and foremost goal to protect their funding stream, as opposed to being able to stand back and answer an honest question: is what we're doing making a difference? So what we have done in this nation, very sadly, is as we've closed down these places to help people, we've replaced that bed in the asylum with a jail cell, with a park bench in homelessness, with a gurney in an emergency room where a person's given a 5-point tie down and chemical sedatives, and we've given them a coffin. What a shame, what a failure our system has. What we also have to acknowledge as part of this is serious mental illness cannot be treated with just awareness, and it cannot be treated with anti-stigma campaigns. I don't care how many commercials you put on TV and says mental illness is not a bad thing and we shouldn't stigmatize it. That's not enough. That's not a treatment. Think of the stigma that used to be there with cancer. Now, some of you are old enough to understand. You're probably, most of you are under 30 years old. But let's say some of you are old enough to understand or recall that there was a time you never said the cancer word, right? And now what happens if you have a Susan B. Komen race for the cure? Tens of thousands of people show up wearing pink shirts with great sayings on them. NFL football players wear pink socks and pink gloves to celebrate our work for breast cancer that we wouldn't talk about a few years ago. What an amazing difference. But it didn't stop there. They didn't just wear pink and the awareness was done. They put millions of dollars into research and focused a great deal on things that needed to be done. And that is what has made a difference, but not when it comes to federal funding. We also have to recognize you cannot treat mental illness by putting up more barriers because some groups believe the barriers are important. It just cannot be done that way. Anytime someone says we don't like medication or all they need is housing or you can't force someone into treatment or you can't do something without someone's consent, they're limiting the spectrum of what that individual should have. The federal government, by the way, did this when they have this restricted class of drugs. And sometimes you should YouTube this video. I'm challenging a person by the name of Cohen. And what CMS wanted to do is limit the number of psychiatric drugs available to like one antidepressant, one antipsychotic. Well, anybody who understands things, you can't do that. People have different reactions to different medications. Some are effective, some are not. And it takes weeks sometimes to understand their effectiveness. And it also relates to the age, the gender, the person's own metabolism. Lots of dynamics go in there. So in this question I had in our health subcommittee, I asked Mr. Cohen to read a letter from the American Psychiatric Association. And in this letter, he read that the APA was challenging their having to lifting the restricted class of drugs and say that CMS would limit it to a couple. And one of the things they referred to is SSRIs. And it went on. So at the end of him reading this letter, the APA was saying, you're not paying attention to the science of this. I asked him, what is an SSRI? And his response was, I wasn't briefed on that. And I said, and you're making life and death decisions for people. Life and death because a psychiatric medication, they're using a standard of if you're not rehospitalized within 7 days, therefore they can do whatever they want. And I said, but some of these medications may take 2 to 6 weeks to take effect. And also to have the end of a previous effect of a drug before you can start another one. And there's all sorts of things that go in this. I said, secondly, let's look at some of the evidence. When someone who was elderly commits suicide, 20% of them do it on the day of a doctor visit, 40% within a week of a doctor visit, and 70% within a month of a doctor visit. And what you're saying here is we will allow these elderly to go ahead and commit suicide because you're not going to allow treatment of them, of medication. And I said, I challenged him to go back and eliminate that rule. As a matter of fact, I asked if he had physicians advising him. He said, yes, several worked at HHS. I said, are any of them practicing psychiatrists? And he couldn't answer that question. So I said, then you are practicing medicine without a license, and you should stop, and you should reverse and eliminate this rule. And two things happened soon afterwards. By the next week, they reversed the rule, and soon after, he resigned. I don't know if there's any relationship between that. But it shows you what happens in the federal government where they just look at metrics such as money, or they look at issues by setting up some bizarre standards that really don't relate to the field of understanding the brain. So the stigma we're dealing with here in many areas, in California and every other state is dealing with this, you have some group that is looking at emotional well-being and fads. And SAMHSA, one of the federal organizations, funds a lot of this. I take strong issue with it, that offering a grant to have a coloring book which has characters in it which are making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich because that boosts their self-esteem, I'm not sure that's the way. Or some of the campaigns they use for this, and I think some of that funding is much better directed towards that group that is neglected, and that is the seriously mentally ill. So understand, I want to be very clear, mental illness is not a social value, and it's not a difference of opinion. It is not a non-consensus reality, and indeed, that's what some people talk about it is. It is a brain disease. It is a neurological condition. It has an interaction between biological conditions and environmental factors, too. But you don't just get rid of it by wishing it away, by having awareness of it away, or by denying a spectrum of treatments. And as I said in my opening, when treated properly, people can and do get better. And our goal is to help them get back to productive and independent lives as much as possible. We want community-based care for everyone who can use it, but there also has to be a means to intervene when a crisis occurs. The current system is one, however, that those who need the help the most have the most difficulty navigating a system that is very difficult. So who is it that needs help most? Let's look at the families. And you realize as a family member, you really are given a lot of barriers to treatment when you see a loved one spiraling into the depths of a severe mental illness who can't help themselves. So here's an important thing to understand. And the term is called anosognosia. Now, I have to admit, back when I was in graduate school, we didn't even use that term, but we have much more awareness of it now. And again, some groups deny that this even exists, but it is absolutely true. About 40% of persons with severe mental illness are not aware they have a mental illness. This is a frontal lobe disorder. This is a brain disorder. Let's look at other areas where this exists. Alzheimer's. A person with Alzheimer's disease very often is not aware that they have Alzheimer's. They are not aware they have a memory disorder or other deteriorating neurological condition. And if you go up to someone with Alzheimer's disease who is pretty far along, they may make reference to past things in their lives, et cetera, but when you try and help them understand why they can't drive a car, why they need to be under supervision, et cetera, they may not comprehend what you're talking about at all. So do we just say to them, oh, that's okay, then that's fine. We'll let you make that decision. How about someone with a head trauma that doesn't understand? We see this a lot in Navy medicine, where someone with a pretty significant head injury from a blast or something else that is not aware because they can no longer think and comprehend and step back and have that meta-analysis of their own problems. They cannot do that. And when it comes to delusions and psychosis and schizophrenia, they don't just think they're hearing messages or that they are the Archangel Michael. They know they are. They don't think the FBI is after them. The FBI is after them. They don't think the CIA has secretly planted electrodes in their brain and beaming them messages from outer space. They know it's true. They don't think that in one case, Will Bruce thought his mother was an Al-Qaeda operative and chopped her to pieces because he believed that and didn't stop believing it until he got on medication. CNN wrote a great article about this a couple weeks ago. So since they know that their experiences are real, they will never volunteer for treatment. As a matter of fact, if you try and talk about them with treatment in whatever compassionate mechanism, anyhow, for those, as I was saying, with anosognosia, they're uncomfortable acknowledging the depth of their problems, and they are also then caught up in their own paranoia and delusions. And the victims of this oftentimes are themselves or their families or other persons there. So let's go back to my example of a person with Alzheimer's disease. A person, for example, an 80-year-old who was wandering the streets, not just an area like here in San Francisco, but perhaps in the colder North Country, that we don't go up to that person and say, are you okay? Do you need help? And they say, I have to get back to school because my second grade teacher expects me in class now and then recess is over. You don't say, okay, that's fine. You're on your own. Compassion and awareness of the brain would drive us to say, this person is not capable of making a sound decision. And so we would reach out and help them and take them to the hospital and make sure they are getting the care they need. Similar, we would never deny treatment to that person because that person can articulate treatment. Nor would we deny treatment to a person, for example, who was in an auto accident and was in a coma and saying, I'm sorry, this person isn't aware and isn't capable of right now consenting to treatment, so let's hold off. So in case of serious brain disorders, millions suffer because the law says we cannot act when we know that we must. We don't do this with cancer or diabetes or heart disease, but we do this with this one narrow area of mental illness because the biggest stigma that exists is the absolute misinformed group who still believes that somehow a person with a mental illness is willfully mentally ill, and if only you can talk them out of it, they can get better. It is absolute denial of the role of the brain in here. Now, until we get through this barrier and help people understand fact and science, we cannot break through this barrier to be compassionate. So again, I go back to that point. Despite someone's good intentions to help someone, if they deny a person with mental illness the spectrum of treatment which may benefit them, they're actually harming that patient. So when I say that the laws actually make it so a person with mental illness suffers, that is wrong. We have people who have a deteriorating brain disease and say, we're not going to help you until you try to kill someone else yourself. This is a perverse and inhumane standard by any measure for people who cannot make an informed choice for themselves. So this is why I introduced the Helping Families in Mental Health Crisis Act. It delivers help to the seriously mentally ill who need better treatment, real treatment, not excuses, not delays, and not more small talk. So far, we have 100 co-sponsors this bill. It has the broadest support in Congress from families, from Republicans and Democrats, mental health groups, and advocates. And in summary, this bill does the following things. It promotes community-based living and the supportive services necessary for those with mental illness. It improves community mental health services by integrating mental health and treatment at community mental health centers. It reauthorizes the Garrett Lee Smith Suicide Prevention Act resources for suicide education and prevention. It reauthorizes mental health courts. It takes care of what I was describing before about the limitations of psychotropic drugs in Medicaid and Medicare. It creates an interagency council on serious mental illness and an assistant secretary for mental health and substance abuse. It deals with health information technology for mental health. It reauthorizes federal programs focused on mental health for children and youth. It authorizes research in the National Institute of Mental Health, including early identification of mental illness, the program called RAISE, or Response After Initial Schizophrenic Episode, and other programs that have evidence-based research behind them. My legislation invests in community-based care, not institutionalized care. Title II of the bill also requires new federally qualified behavioral health clinics to adopt peer support and recovery services. In Title I, there's a new national policy laboratory test merging best practices to develop evidence-informed treatments for use at community mental health centers. It attests emerging practices like peer support and the recovery model. This cooperative, inclusive approach to care is what we say needs to come first, but it has to be inclusive and it has to be broad-based. And by inclusive and broad-based, that's the opposite of those who wanted to not be inclusive. They wanted to be separated out into chunks and deny people some care that they need. That's not right. It also includes mechanisms to have honest and open communication between providers and consumers where appropriate, families and guardians. Now, we recognize advance directives are helpful so that family members can have access to information when needed, but we also know sometimes a person who may sign an advance directive may at another moment revoke it when they are in the depths of their crisis. And we need to make sure we have mechanisms so that care can continue for that person when it is necessary for them to receive that care and prevents them from becoming gravely disabled. Now, so on these issues, there's a lot of common ground among members of Congress and various bills, but we also have to recognize there's places where this system is broken and build care where it currently fails. So here is where the Helping Families and Mental Health Crisis Act seeks to rebuild this broken system and help those who need it the most. I mentioned before having an assistant secretary of mental health and substance abuse. Keep this in mind, of that $130 billion is scattered throughout many federal agencies, Department of Defense, Department of Veterans Affairs, Department of Health and Human Services, Department of Justice, Department of Education, maybe even Department of Labor, Department of Transportation, who knows where else. But my point is this secretary should comb through very carefully all the federal agencies, look at those programs, and do what I said before. If it's not effective, transfer the money to something that is. If it's redundant, merge it. If it's within multiple federal agencies, make sure they work smoothly. The greatest example being Department of Defense, a soldier who is suffering from a mental illness, a handoff to the VA where there's absolutely no handoff. Even the medical record systems are different. And then if that person goes on to other community-based care, there's a problem there. It's also important to put mental health issues on the same plane as physical health. You cannot integrate them if you continue to deny their existence. And there's those members in Congress who also have that approach to deny that there are brain disorders that lead to this and some of the other symptoms I described before. But this is not another level of a barrier of bureaucracy which gets in the way. This is, as far as I can tell, the first assistant secretary in the federal government whose sole job it is to break down the barriers and bring them together, give Congress an annual report of what needs to be done with these, that first report within a year, but also review what states are doing with mental health parity and prepare a report card for Congress in terms of how states are doing. I'll tell you, nothing seems to motivate a state quite like seeing your ranking compared to other states. On measures such as the kind of care you provide, and results such as homelessness, incarcerations, violence, victimization, emergency room visits, etc. That will help. You know, I think if we actually had this assistant secretary, it would not have taken us 5 years to get the regulations for mental health parity. But now we have regulations, but it's going to take another while before states even do anything. In the meantime, many people suffer. Our bill also works to increase the number of hospital beds. Now, one of the problems is if you need inpatient care, even if there's sign-off from people, you can't get it. There were 550,000 hospital beds, psychiatric hospital beds in this country in the 1950s. At that time, the population of the United States was 150 million. Now, when we have a population of the United States of 360 million, there's less than 40,000 psychiatric beds. 49 to 50 states have what's called a critical or severe bed shortage. And so what happens is many of these folks go to crowded emergency rooms, where we have heard in our hearings that some as young as 6 years old, we've heard about, and remain there for days, and some have remained there for weeks or over 100 days in a five-point tie-down with someone sitting there observing them, oftentimes given a chemical straitjacket. Now, when you think about this, and again, I go back to this point when people thought, well, you really shouldn't coerce or compel someone into treatment because you want them to have freedom. How does that person have freedom? There is no freedom at all for them. They can't make decisions. They still remain in a crisis. We deny them care. And anybody who thinks that's compassionate, just to say this person who is out of control is best served by being tied to a gurney for days, hours, weeks, months, there's nothing compassionate about that at all. Same thing if that person who, when encountered by a police officer, hits the police officer, was just giving a talk somewhere and someone described how their son was tasered multiple times and finally shot and killed by the police. How is that freedom? What constitutional rights do we protect for that man? Or persons who, when police officers encounter them, police were, admittedly, they said, look, we're not trained as social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists. We don't know what to do. They encounter someone. They've got to do a quick check there. They're not sure what things to say. Who do you touch? Who do you not touch? Who do you use concrete words with? Who can use a metaphor and simile and all those things? Who will you upset? If they don't have training and background, that the situation can oftentimes get exacerbated. So the policeman gets struck by someone. Now you have the person with a felony charge on them. What good have we done? But we really don't have places to take them as far as care for someone who's in acute crisis. The most famous case being, of course, Cree Deeds. Tried to take his son, Gus, to a hospital in Virginia. They said there's no beds. They searched around, couldn't find any. And, of course, we know the story of what happened with Gus, stabbed his father. His father ran, Senator Deeds ran, and Gus sadly killed himself. Again, I ask you, for those who are actively fighting creation of more hospital beds, go explain that to Senator Deeds. Go explain that to the many families who've been in a similar situation, and they cannot, because there is no compassion involved with denying necessary care. So what our bill does is it prohibits Medicaid rule that says between ages 21 and 64, you are prevented from getting inpatient care from a hospital with more than 16 beds. I don't know where they came up with this metric, but it is certainly not in the realm of what we know in medicine. If you have private insurance, you may have a plan that actually gets you the best treatment from freestanding psychiatric hospitals. And Medicaid, though, you cannot. And keep in mind this. If you're low income, the good news is you get free health care. The bad news is you can't use it because Medicaid has rules that says you can't. This is discriminatory, and it is wrong. What happens is 3717 means mental health for mental health parity for Medicaid begins for those who need inpatient care. Here's an interesting number to note. For cancer treatment centers, there's 900 cancer hospitals. In cardiac care, there's 708 units around the country. Psychiatric hospitals, 413. And yet again, I told you that if we have 10 million people with severe mental illness and 4 million of those without treatment, you're going to need a lot more than this for those moments of crisis when someone needs it. So the decision about whether or not you get a hospital shouldn't be based on whether you need it, not how much money you have, or not what Medicaid says. This bill seeks to change that. Next in our bill are incentives to deal with assisted outpatient treatment or involuntary outpatient treatment, or as you have in California here, Laura's Law, right? New York, Kendra's Law, Florida, it's many states have different names for those, based upon a tragic situation that sadly is what motivates us to action. So assisted outpatient treatment, it's important to note, is an alternative to jail or versus involuntary inpatient hospitalization. Only four states continue that do not have laws on our book. Now, what we say in our bill is a condition of receiving federal money, you must have some law on your book and work this. Now, as this goes through, I recognize the law itself is not enough. A law is not generically good nor bad in terms of making something happen. States and counties have to do a lot of work. You have a number of counties, including where we are now, who have had the courage to say, we have to do this for persons who need help. Something to know is in the federal government, there was almost unanimous that we had passed into law in April a bill to create an assisted outpatient treatment grant program, $15 million a year for 4 years. $60 million will go to this for communities that use assisted outpatient treatment. So our county here would be part of that. But they say that they... I help understand this. We're talking about 1% of 1%. This is not a pervasive thing. This is not trying to take everybody's rights away. This is for those who we still think can, with treatment, be out in the community, back to work, back to doing things. And you probably have your own stories on this, too. I'm sure you do. But the world is filled with stories of persons who, unfortunately, now have no more rights because they're in jail, or if we talk to families, they have no idea where their son or daughter is somewhere in this country, homeless. And they have no more rights there. But we believe that assisted outpatient treatment, which is not for everyone, it's helpful in some cases when a person has a history of violence, cycles in and out of jails, cycles in and out of emergency rooms and inpatient units, and in the absence of treatment becomes gravely disabled. So in other words, where there's evidence the person can get better and evidence that without treatment the person deteriorates and becomes much worse, this is a mechanism where due process occurs to protect their rights that AOT can be effective. So in New York, a study that was done by Duke University on Kendra's Law and also the Virginia Law Center studied what happens to persons who go through this process versus those who do not. What they found is there was 87% fewer incarcerations, 83% fewer arrests, 77% fewer psychiatric hospitalizations, 74% fewer homelessness, and 55% fewer recipients engaged in suicide attempts or physical harm to self. Now, AOT not only produces outcomes like that, but it also saves money, a great deal of money, I think cut by almost 50% the cost. In the state of Maryland, let's look at the opposite. In the state of Maryland, a study followed 500 patients who oftentimes cycle through the system. And I don't believe this includes cost of the judicial system, but just in cost of treatment and everything else that goes with it. These 500 patients cost the state of Maryland $36.9 million for 1 year. 1 year for 500 patients. Now, what would have happened if there was a mechanism in Maryland, which there is not, to make sure someone remains in care? There's also a current story in Maryland we're following where a mother, schizophrenic mother with schizophrenia, disappeared with her two children, and now they're looking for her. She apparently told her husband she had to go pick up the kids. He's been trying to trace them, track them down. We don't know what happened. We hope the children are okay. But what a difference that would have been in Maryland if someone was cycling in and out of help and was not getting that help. You have to raise a question for her and for other cases, too, would it made a difference. So four states still prohibit the use of this model, and most county health systems, for example, in California, have not yet implemented it. But studies have shown that each time an individual with mental illness experiences a break from reality, we have to also note that the brain actually suffers some permanent injury. So while people are saying, well, you know, we really should compel people into treatment, we're saying we're talking about 1% of 1%, very carefully defining their things. And when people in government say, we're not going to make this happen, they are responsible for calling the shots and hurting people's care, too. The list goes on, too. I just want to mention HIPAA, too, that HIPAA laws, part of what we say here is when it comes to the HIPAA laws, as part of the process of moving this bill forward, not only did we get funding passed with regard to assisted outpatient treatment, but also HHS put out a clarification. It's important to understand for providers, because many times they don't. You can listen to family members who provide history to you. You can. Many times they say, I'm sorry, we can't talk to you. But it is a situation that if you are not collecting history for a psychiatric case, it's the same as telling an orthopedic surgeon you're not allowed to look at an X-ray. You're telling a neurosurgeon you can't look at that MRI. It's just wrong. What we see here is that as we're reviewing the wording of this, look upon it that allowing a professional, a licensed professional, who has to adhere to the highest level of their professional ethics under limited circumstances, when they know that this is a loving caregiver, family member, whatever they are, loving caregiver, who will take responsibility, may have access to limited information such as next appointment, diagnosis, treatment plan, and but you don't have to know everything else, when it is necessary for that person to adhere to treatment. Finally, I want to say that there are those who are opposed to some things in this bill, but usually behind that you can see that we're looking at cutting their funding, because one of the things I also want to note is they should not be using federal funding to lobby to block treatment, and that's what happens. Now, there are those who want me to compromise and settle for the status quo, and I won't. I'll work with anybody, but on some of these principles when it comes to caring for someone, why should we compromise? The analogy I would use is if you went to a physician and he said, this is the pill you need to take, and this is the treatment you need to participate in, but why don't we compromise and let's just agree to do 10% of this. You won't get better, but it'll cost us less money, and at least we'll feel better that we did something. That's pretending. I'll close you with a story here. You're involved in a courageous battle. And I hate to use that term battle, but that's where we are. But it's going to take this continued courage and work to make some things happen. And I want to tell you a little story about someone that I knew, someone who in the military, a soldier, a young man in his 20s, I'll withhold enough information to not to violate HIPAA laws, a young man in his 20s who himself was hit pretty bad by a blast. And in that blast, it affected the left side of his brain pretty significantly. Now, part of my role as a psychologist in the Navy is I have to sit down and talk with other family members and help explain to them what the outcome is and help them with their reactions to this. So I was talking to his young wife, a lovely young lady. And I was walking through his effects. And I said, because it affected his frontal lobe, you'll see some personality changes in him. Some things will come back. I don't know how soon or how much, but he'll improve. And because it affected some things in his temporal lobe, his language skills will be affected, both what he says, and right now he's silent. He speaks like a person with like a stroke victim, and in terms of what he comprehends, that being greatly affected, and he couldn't use similes or metaphors with them. He's very concrete based in his language. But his language is improving. We didn't know how much or how soon, but it's getting better. And his parietal lobe was affected, so he was hemiplegic. His right side was badly affected. I said, look, I don't know if he'll be able to write again with his right hand, but he can do with his left. I don't think he'll shave with his right or button a button or zip a zipper, but his left hand is improving, and he is walking now. We don't know how much or how soon he'll get better, but we'll see some improvement. Now, this comes in the background of understanding. A lot of times when we talk to members of military families, people abandon that soldier. I mean abandon. And so much so that sometimes they clean out their bank account, take their vehicle, they're gone. And so we're oftentimes concerned what's going to happen when dealing with one of these heroes that now will be impaired for life. So as I was describing this to her, and I saw tears come down her face, I said, what will you do? And what's your reaction to this? And she said, I don't mean to sound cruel or insensitive to those families who have faced this, but I envy those whose husbands don't come home. but at least they can get on with their lives. And she added to that, I sent this handsome young soldier to war, and I don't know who this man is that came back with his name. He is a stranger to me. So now, fearing the worst, I said, what will you do? And she straightened up and said, I made that decision on my wedding day. She said, if it takes me 50 years, I'll teach him to laugh and love again. Beautiful words. Now, when a soldier goes into combat, even though they may be up for the fight, they certainly hope against the fight and hope that they don't get harmed. They run towards the sound of the gunfire, as I say. But still, you don't want that to happen every day. Look at her mission in life. Every day she has to run towards the sound of the gunfire. Every day she's in combat. Every day she's in a battle. But what she's committed herself to is, despite all those things, driven by love and compassion, she will overcome those things. And that's what comes down to you too. There are some who are saying, well, let's look at the Constitution, let's look at rights, let's look at rules and follow these things because we want to help those who, whatever. You are motivated by love, and I'll guarantee you that force is much, much, much stronger. But don't, in the words of Winston Churchill, never, 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 never give up. Because that is what it's going to take to change us. We have to educate people, we have to inform people, we have to work with people, and we have to continue to convince members of Congress and your folks in your counties and the providers to understand that people can and do get better if we do the right thing. Thank you for your hard work on this, and God bless.
Thank you. You're listening to a program from the Commonwealth Club of California by Honorable Tim Murphy on reforming our broken mental health system. And now audience questions will be asked by the Honorable Helen Thompson, who as Assemblywoman in 2002 was the sponsor of Laura's Law, the California law that allows for state-ordered outpatient treatment using antipsychotics for those with severe mental illness.
It is on. Very good. Thank you very much, Congressman, for being here. This question starts off with thank you for going on this tour to talk about this issue, which is so affecting so many people and their families. And the first question is, what will it take for Democrats and Republicans to come together on this issue?
Well, a lot of Democrats and Republicans are coming together on this issue, and I'm pretty amazed that if you look at some people's voting records, it probably couldn't be any different on many other issues. But on this, there are some real champions working on this. I'm leaving here a little bit to go to Congressman Jeff Denham's district, a Republican. Also a great ally, a Democrat, is Congressman Jim McDermott up in Seattle, or Lewis Capps in Cleveland, a Democrat there. Alcee Hastings, a Democrat from Florida. Vern Buchanan, a Republican from Florida. A wide spectrum there. And it really is a matter of sitting down and talking to them and telling them your story and asking them to keep an open mind and giving them factual information. As parents, it helps to move them with true stories of what happens, success stories, as well as understanding what happens because the laws are not there or not enforced or because there's barriers that are put up. It is a matter of that, but be continuous and understand that there's other people out there who says, we don't want our funding cut, we don't want this changed, and other people who are fighting their own battles. I understand those who are against Kendra's law because they may themselves have had bad experiences. I get that, and we should never repeat those bad experiences. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't allow people the right to treatment. They keep saying people should have the right to say no to treatment. I said they should have the right to get better. They should have the right to be fulfilled lives, and that's why it's courageous what you did. Sad motivation was in Kendra's case, but nonetheless, things that we should do.
Thank you. In California, counties are beginning to enact Laura's Law. The Disability Rights of America has announced that it will initiate lawsuits against any counties that do so, and they are reportedly using Prop 63 funds to do this. Any comments on legalities of this using that kind of money for these issues?
You have to check your legality of Prop 63 funds, but I believe on the federal level it's wrong and it's illegal for them to use federal funds for lobbying. We'll be investigating this in my role as chairman. I also think that there's substantial information there. Look, this was passed by your state legislatures. Mm-hmm. It's reviewed by elected officials in the county. It's gone through the courts. on inpatient issues. It's been debated many times. It's gone through the court saying this is legal. This has been a standard for a couple centuries in terms of imminent danger of harming themselves or someone else. We're talking about trying to get people care. It's going to be an area where when people show up in your county elected officials' offices, you're going to have to be there too in the audience and get other people to be there as well. give them facts. Help them understand. And when these groups start talking with some of their comments about, their rights, et cetera, some of you may stand up and say, what rights does my son have? He's in a jail now. What rights does my daughter have? I don't know where she is. She's on a park bench somewhere. She's living a terrible life. They can't answer that. And ultimately, the question that I have for them, including my colleagues, is, should Adam Lanza have been compelled to be in treatment? Should Jared Lochner have been compelled to be in treatment? Look in your own state here. Elliot Rogers. His parents, what a sad, sad story they had rushing around Santa Barbara County that night. Should Elliot Rogers have been compelled to be in treatment? They don't have an answer for that, except say, well, there was no evidence early on. Yes, there was ample evidence. Ample evidence. And sometimes what we have to say is if that person's not capable of making a decision, we need to help them. It's a move of compassion.
Thank you. Can the IMD exclusion language be passed separately from the entire bill?
Well, the good news is the IMD exclusion, we've gotten some attention on that. What we're looking at here is trying to gather some of the data with regard to the hospital beds and the costs. To move a bill through Congress, a Congressional Budget Office has to measure how much it's going to cost. Obviously, that'll be an increased cost for the federal and state governments. But what we're doing is asking hospital associations to give us some data of what it costs now to have someone in emergency rooms. We'd also love to have information from states in terms of what they're paying in Medicaid, et cetera, for people who are in and out of emergency rooms or in and out of hospital beds. That's a non-psychiatric bed. To have that kind of care. To also look at incarceration costs and homelessness cost coverage. To help people understand we're spending a lot of money and spending much, much more. And if we permitted some of these psychiatric hospital beds, it may actually work out. So that's some of the inside the beltway things we have to do to get factual information to the Congressional Budget Office. Because if they just say, well, it's going to cost X numbers of billions more per year to provide people hospital care, we could say, yes, but it saves money because emergency room care can be 3 to 4 times more than having them in an acute care hospital bed. By the way, I should also say our bill, it says that we want the average length of stay to be under 30 days. So this isn't long-term hospitalization we're pushing for. It's getting a person stable so they can get back in outpatient care and on their own.
Very good. Can you comment on the practice of signing up mentally ill persons for SSI payments while they're hospitalized so that upon release they are given small stipends with no oversight, no requirement for treatment, and requirement for treatment? And compliance for a 3-year period, the role this plays to contributing to the homeless?
This is a very important question. I've had discussions with this with some of my other colleagues in Congress who are on the Ways and Means Committee. This is in their jurisdiction. About $90 billion of that $130 billion we spend each year in mental health is on disability. And to have people with disability funding with no requirement they stay in treatment, I think, is a concern. Again, I think that's a bizarre thing the federal government should be working. If our real goal is helping someone, we ought to say you need to stay in treatment to have this. Some level of treatment, work with people, provide the services necessary. That would be valuable, and so we're working on that. A second part of that I also think would actually be extremely valuable for those who are on disability payments. Why do we cap their income? In the sense that, so in my community, some of these folks might be baggers at a local grocery store. But they can only make so much money that guarantees they must remain in poverty. Yeah. Now, why would we do that? Why not let them make a little more money? You can cap their disability payments, but let them make some more so they actually become independent. You want to help people's self-esteem, let them begin to be employed and have some money in there, too. And again, we're looking at some analysis of that. The federal government actually makes more money in that because people become taxpayers, and that's powerful. So we're looking at that as well, and I think those are going to be done.
Very good. The consumer movement is very powerful in our county. Many deny that mental illness exists as a medical condition. Families advocating for the kinds of policies and services you recommend have difficulty getting our elected officials to consider their perspectives. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, one thing is that the California Psychiatric Association and adolescent and family psychiatrists and psychologists, et cetera, need to go meet these people and give them information. same with those in neuroscience. A large study on schizophrenia recently revealed 100 genetic links to genomes related to schizophrenia. A study that was just published out of Australia actually found that also among some women who had related some inflammation markers had a much higher risk for offspring with schizophrenia. There's a lot of medical markers for this that we didn't even think existed 10, 20 years ago. They are there. We're learning more. And we need to identify those more carefully. For those who think that there's no medical aspects there, it's one of the greatest stigmas that is out there. Providing false information for people and providing really false hope. It is really no more advanced than the Salem witch trials. It is no more advanced in those days when we said, let's just, you know, hose people down. That used to be a treatment. Give them ice baths, lobotomies, or whatever it was to subdue them rather than treat them. There was a lot of medical evidence there. But I think this is where I call upon the psychiatric associations to really say our field can provide important services. For psychologists, say providing appropriate psychotherapy in conjunction with other treatments can provide significant help. For psychiatric social workers, say here's the treatment we do and here's how we help them with their lives, their homes, et cetera, how all these things working together. But you have to have that spectrum of care. But if their first treatment is denial, it's insensitive, it's calloused, it's misguided, it's unethical, and it's immoral, and it is wrong. And this is where you have to be armed to fight back against those falsehoods with facts, because it is absolutely false what they're trying to perpetrate.
That's a very good answer. Thank you very much. Some programs which seem valuable, i.e. the socialization programs, don't yet have evidence to prove their effectiveness. Would they lose federal support under your plan?
Well, what we look at in those programs is teaming them up with those who can help them do proper research on that. For example, AOT and peer support are shown to be pretty effective. Peer support on its own is not as effective for those, that small group. It really is providing a spectrum there. I think in many cases, when SAMHSA of 500-some employees only had one psychiatrist and they have hired a second one while we started our investigation, so we said, oh, good, you doubled your number of psychiatrists there. They have some very good psychologists. They have some very good scientists there, and they also have a lot of people who do not understand how to do research. So it is a matter of working with them, because perhaps in many ways they don't know how to design the study and do it. I mean, I've met with some groups who said, you mean you want us to do a double-blind study to determine whether or not this works? You can't do that. I said, why not? Why can't you look upon those who are in treatment and those who refuse what you're doing? That in alone. So if a group, for example, there's something called the Hawthorne effect. Came out years ago from an AT&T lab called Hawthorne, and that is, by the fact that you're doing any study at all, people will respond. But the situation with this is to say, for those who remained in treatment, oftentimes you will see positive effects whatever their treatment is, versus those who dropped out of treatment. Why? Compare what's going on there. But you can also compare different types of treatments for effectiveness, and that is what the standard we have to have. But again, if they deny there's medical components and they deny any role in science, and yet they tell us we should listen to their subjective facts. There is no facts involved. Let's use standards of science and rigor. I'm open to that, and I think we can find in many cases some things they provide is helpful. But I also say that those who say if only we provided housing for them, that would be sufficient, it's just wrong. I mean, again, it's insensitive, it's uninformed. The housing is incredibly important. It is not the whole thing. So what she's saying for those who are listening, she's saying that, you know, that sequestration caught, let me finish, that sequestration cut some of those. And certainly I don't know where California stands and what it provides for housing. Housing is very important, certainly for those who are homeless. But that is not the whole story here. But when they cut the family off from being part of treatment and trying to bring things together, and did not provide housing and also did not provide other treatment, housing alone is not enough. It is important. Believe me, I want the sequester to stop. I want the president's plan of sequester to end. We need to do that for lots of reasons, not the least of which is this. And Congress wants that to happen too. So this will be part of where we will go with this. But my point is, for those who say that's the whole thing, that is enough. But housing is a very, very important part of this.
Some say that the 3717 provision for banning lobbying by identified groups is unconstitutional and not consistent with political freedom. Please comment.
Well, they're wrong. Your tax dollars should not be used to pay some group to lobby against what Congress is saying. I just can't. And when we've had hearings on this, Democrats and Republicans alike said, well, they shouldn't be doing this. I said, yeah, but they are. So what oftentimes they say is, well, we're not using the federal part of our 90% of our budget. We're using this tiny little percent here, too. Yeah, even though we're using the same rooms and the same staff, their salaries are paid by this. They should be allowed and welcome the scrutiny, because if they're using federal tax dollars, then they have to have transparency that is demanded by taxpayers to say, how are you spending that money? And if they say, we don't want scrutiny to determine if what we're doing is of value, we don't want the scrutiny to be standing under science, we don't want you to look at our outcomes, just take our word for it and please give us the money. And by the way, you know, we're not really lobbying. Look, I have also seen where these organizations, and part of the congressional mandate, have to have an advisory panel, congressional mandate. And they tell their advisory panel members that one of the things they want them to do is to go out and lobby Congress. That is an absolute direct violation of the law. But that's what they do. Now, no money is there, but it's part of what they're telling their people to do. As they say, you know, let's stop this bill. I'll be glad to work with them and certainly work to find some solutions to these many things. But this is part where they're really not allowed to do that. And they have to stop.
How do you respond to arguments that modifying the HIPAA rules to allow needed communications between doctors and family members will prevent individuals from seeking treatment?
Well, right now, when it comes to preventing individuals seeking treatment, if you have 40% of those with serious mental illness not seeking treatment, you have a problem. And if people are not seeking treatment because in the depths of their deep depression or schizophrenia or bipolar illness or whatever else they have, they're not seeking treatment because they think that their parent or other family member or friend is part of their paranoia and avoiding treatment, that's a problem. I'd like to see evidence of that. I mean, they make a claim. But what I see is the evidence currently as a stance we heard repeatedly from persons giving us testimony that that parents were denied even the opportunity, family members, loving family members, were denied the opportunity even to give information to physicians in terms of who's the treating psychiatrist or what medication this person's on. And denied the opportunity even to listen, to provide information and get any information at all. And the result is that person then is back on the streets or having problems again. Notice what we're saying in a very limited way and adhering to the highest level of professional ethics under limited circumstances when it's necessary for that person to continue care, without of which they become gravely disabled, to only give that family limited information. Now, not saying, you know, tell me all the things that you don't like about your mom and dad or things you've done back in school. None of that is in there. What we want to say is at least those elements that are necessary for adherence to treatment. Mm-hmm. That would be helpful. I mean, if someone with heart disease, or someone with a stroke, would they do the same standard for you on that?
No.
And say, well, your person has a stroke, but we think that if we tell you the treatment they need in physical therapy or medication, that they will no longer adhere to it. The difference here is what's happening with the brain, and this goes back to the ignorance that this is a brain illness. So it all fits neatly in their package as long as they say it's not a brain issue, it's just an attitude issue, and if you only talk to them about their attitude, it'll all change. That magical thinking isn't real. So, yeah.
That leads into this question, which is, would you think that using brain disorder instead of mental disorder or mental illness might reduce stigma? Since there is so little stigma against heart disorders, liver disorders, et cetera.
Well, there may be something too that it helps reduce some of the stigma if we call it what it is. The mental disorder has gone through centuries of incredible misunderstandings of being possessed, or you needed to be stoned or burned at the stake or punished or scourged or something to get this out of your system. I certainly hope that we can understand this more as a brain disorder and see it for what it is. There's other psychosocial aspects of this. We know that the stresses involved in life also affect people. We don't want to deny that as an important component of this. But I want us to, again, always be looking at the spectrum of what is needed to help the person get better, and don't deny a person part of that spectrum.
More and more police officers are asking for time off for compensation and therapy for PTSD incurred after shooting and killing a seriously mentally ill person because they felt threatened and didn't know how to handle the situation. How do we find out about those costs and the psychological guilt and monetary cost?
I don't know, but that's something we need to follow up on. I mean, part of our bill actually provides grant programs for police officers to have additional training. In Dade County, Florida, we saw a report where of 5,000 police encounters with someone mentally ill, there was only 5 arrests. We know sometimes a person who's mentally ill seeks suicide by cop. Or there's also situations where the situation just deteriorates rapidly because police may not have the training, or there was a threat to them by someone. And the police oftentimes can tell you who are the people in the neighborhoods or their community or their beat that have these problems. But that is part of the cost outcome we have to see as well. You're right. We'll look at that.
And I think maybe this is the last question. Are you willing to compromise to work out a joint approach with the Democratic bill?
Well, first of all, the Democrat bill, about 40% of the Democrat bill is my bill. Okay.
You'll accept that part of it for sure.
Sure. There are parts in there that I have strong disagreements with. For example, they removed in their bill, I mean, ours is the bipartisan bill, theirs is the partisan bill. They removed in their bill any accountability for SAMHSA. I think that there should be accountability. They removed in their bill the assisted outpatient treatment portion. They removed in their bill HIPAA changes. And then they said they don't even want to discuss those things. Well, you know, that it sounds nice to say maybe we should compromise. It sounds nice. And I notice I said very clearly I'm willing to work with anybody to find solutions. What I'm not willing to do is to pretend we're doing something, saying just because we did something, we did the right thing. I'm just doing the right thing. And I go back to this point, too, and it's a good point to close with. I am obligated by my own professional ethics as a psychologist, and many of you as treating professionals too, that I don't compromise when it comes to giving you treatment. If you came to me with an adolescent with early signs of schizophrenia and I said, you know, I know we should do here, but I'm just going to do part of it because I'm kind of busy right now, and you would call the ethics board on me, right? If a hospital had someone come into the emergency room and they said, well, we don't really have a psychiatrist on our staff or can't be here for several days, but what we're going to do is we recognize you got a great insurance plan, so what we're going to do is kind of keep you here for several days and pretend we're doing something. How about that as a compromise? At least we'll give you some time off. You'd say that's unethical. That's unprofessional. You can't do that. When they refer to the term compromise, if it is let's work on some wording that still gets us towards our goal, I'm okay with that. But if their term of compromise is don't do the things we need to do, then I think that's immoral, unethical, indefensible, uninformed, and wrong. And I don't want to yield on that. And the reason that this bill is moving, and I'm the only practicing mental health professional in the federal government. We have other people there who have been psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, other people there as well, people who understand this issue. And I understand sometimes to move a bill through, you have to work on something in the House and Senate work those weeks. I understand that. But someone in this has to have a strong voice to be able to say that that thing that someone else is proposing is not appropriate. If compromise to them means let's not call this a brain disorder, why compromise on that? I mean, look at other issues, too. This happens all the time in various fields in the federal government. How about we make this proposal? In San Francisco, you know, your regulations dealing with earthquakes are too much. So how about if we compromise and get rid of those so it's much cheaper to build a building? You'd say, I'm not going to live there. That's wrong. How about compromising with clean water standards? How about let's do that? You know, it really is okay to dump some things in the water and drink it. You know, we'll just maybe do 10, 15% pollution in your water. You'd say, that's wrong. There's some things that we know are right. Why would we compromise in things that is a pervasive public health problem of this level? We'll work together. We'll get some things done. But you need to be out there as great voices. And let me end with thanks and gratitude, because in the midst of all this, it is your leadership, it is your drive, there's the things that you've done too, that have been so much a part of making things happen. And in this, we will see results. And I hope there is that bright, shiny day when you can then be back with your loved one or yourself or your recovery and say, we're finally getting better, and we finally see, for the first time in the history of this nation, really identifying a better way to deal with those with mental illness. God bless you all.
Our thanks to the Honorable Tim Murphy for his comments here today. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 110 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.